From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It sounds like a half-menacing oxymoron, a weapon designed to incapacitate but not to kill. As warfare shifts from black and white to gray, proponents of so-called non-lethal weapons say that knockout gases and lasers that immobilize will be key to managing 21st century conflicts. But non-lethal weapons, for all their appeal, raise questions and their own dangers, too, that you might not expect in this hour. Non-lethal weapons and shooting not to kill. First, the UN Security Council voted unanimously today to issue a tough resolution requiring Iraq to quickly show evidence that it no longer has weapons of mass destruction or face serious consequences that may well mean war. I spoke with Washington Post United Nations correspondent Colm Lynch and asked him to explain the strict UN timetable that Iraq now faces.
Essentially, the UN inspectors have scheduled a day to go back. They're going to go back with the chief UN weapons inspector, Hans Blix, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, are going to go to Iraq on November 18th. They're going to have a team of about 25 sort of technical experts. They're going to sort of restore their communication system there. They're going to do a lot of logistical work, and they're going to sort of set up the shop and meet with the Iraqi leadership. Then they will, about a week after that, they'll send over another team of about a dozen inspectors, and they'll start the real inspections at that point, and then they'll just basically build up to about 80 to 100 inspectors over the following weeks.
So Iraq is facing deadlines even within that. First of all, it has to respond within 7 days to this resolution?
Yeah, basically what Iraq has to do is that it has to, in 7 days, it's got to formally commit to implement the resolution. Then it's going to have to put together this sort of massive document within 30 days, which is going to have to lay out the status of its chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons program. It's also going to have to provide a huge sort of dossier on all of the elements of their sort of biological and chemical industrial facilities. Some people don't think they can do it in 30 days, but the Americans have insisted on this issue, and they've gotten their way in the end.
Is there a realistic path for Iraq to comply with this resolution without facing war?
I think so. I mean, I think that now the U.S. has basically begun a process that it's going to have to let play out. It really, at this point, I mean, they've been saying this publicly, but it's really true, is that it's really up to the Iraqi leadership. It's really up to Saddam Hussein. If he provides full cooperation, if he doesn't do anything to interfere with the inspections, lets them do their work, it's going to be very difficult politically for the Americans to go to war. So there is an opportunity to avoid war, but the past has demonstrated that the Iraqis have used every opportunity they could to sort of get around the rules of the game.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair said today, speaking to Saddam, disarm or you face force, be under no doubt whatsoever of that. Is that the shared sentiment of the unanimously voting Security Council?
It's not exactly. There is a broader support in the Council for the possibility of military action if there are serious violations by the Iraqis. But there's going to be a lot of parsing of what a violation is among the members. There are still deep differences over the wisdom of going to war, but the Americans are going to maintain that pressure, and this will hopefully increase the possibilities of credible inspections.
The wire services are reporting today that the resolution, and I'm quoting here, leaves the United States free to attack Iraq without Security Council authorization, that is, without further authorization. Is there consensus on that? Is the U.S. now free, if anything has failed in the demands of Iraq, to go to war?
No, there's not consensus. Essentially, what this resolution does is it's true that this resolution does not place any new legal constraints on the U.S. to use military force. However, it does place political constraints on the U.S. Both the U.S. Ambassador John D. Negroponte and the British Ambassador Jeremy Greenstock, in their statements after the vote, both assured everybody in the Council that if there are violations, we will come back to the Council before we make any decisions about going to war with Iraq. So while they're not bound by this legally, politically they are. There's a process in place, and the Americans are going to have to play this out, and they're going to have to give the Security Council at least an opportunity to to make a judgment about this, but the Americans have made it clear to everybody if the council won't act at that point, they reserve the right to go ahead and use military force to overthrow the regime.
But is there sufficient language here that if the United States should come back and face resistance in the Security Council, let's say weeks down the road now, that they could go to war with Iraq before that winter window dwindled away and say, whether or not the Security Council authorized it again, and say, we have UN endorsement?
I think it's going to be very difficult for them to go to war during this window if there is a sufficient degree of cooperation from the Iraqis. And I think it's going to be difficult politically for the Americans to claim that they have the endorsement of the Security Council without the Council weighing in on this and giving them a formal endorsement. However, there's the example of a case in which the United States and its allies wanted to go to war against Serbia, and there was a threat of a Russian veto. They put together a coalition, and they went outside of a Security Council mandate. That's what the Americans are saying is likely to happen if, when the Council meets, they get a clear sense that the Council is not going to act. Then they will step aside, they will put together a coalition, and they will undertake all necessary means, which means military force, to disarm Iraq.
The resolution passed today gives the inspectors or demands of Iraq, requires of Iraq, immediate, unimpeded, and unconditional rights to search anywhere for banned weapons, including President Saddam Hussein's presidential compounds. Could this be used in a way that would provoke resistance or war, even if Iraq was trying to comply?
Put it this way, there's never in history been an inspection regime that is as intrusive and humiliating as this inspection regime is. Somebody once sort of described the previous UN weapons inspection regime as foreign occupation by remote control, because they have all of these cameras and monitoring devices all over the country looking in at beer factories and all sorts of commercial industrial facilities.
Any place that things ferment in the dark?
Yeah, exactly. And this is far more intrusive. I mean, they can take Iraqi scientists and their families out of the country. They can do anything they want. I mean, no one's been subjected to anything like this, and it's going to be a hard pill for the Iraqis to swallow. But you have a united council on this issue. You've got the threat of war, a very credible threat of war, and so they're just going to have to submit to this rather humiliating regime, or they're going to have to face the real prospect of a military attack by the United States.
Well, how do you read the sense in the halls of the United Nations today? Are we now on a path to Iraq seeing here's the music and we have to disarm, or are we effectively on a path to war that Iraq cannot or will not comply?
I think that countries feel a lot better about this than they did a couple of months ago when Vice President Cheney was running around the country talking about, you know, the need to go to war with Iraq and the uselessness of UN inspectors, that they didn't have the capacity, they didn't have the ability to really disarm Iraq. The U.S. has now sort of charted an inspection course. They're now behind these inspections, and I think that a lot of people in the council feel that this really is an opportunity for the Iraqis to avoid a war, and it's the last opportunity.
And Colin Lynch, we have to give you credit. You told us here at On Point a couple of weeks ago that you expected the Security Council would come around, even when that didn't look immediately obvious from the outside. Why the unanimous vote?
I think that all along in this process, the stakes were so high for countries to keep this whole process within the United Nations. The alternative, which is the U.S. basically doing an end run around the Security Council, diminishes everybody else's influence at the United Nations and in trying to have some hand in dealing with issues involving war and peace in the world. So if the U.S. were to go it alone, it would leave the French out of the picture, it would marginalize the Russians, it would marginalize everybody else. So I think that that's really what played to the Bush administration's advantage, was that the alternative of some sort of agreement was so bad. I mean, the interesting thing was is that Russia and Syria were the last holdouts. Russian Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov called Secretary Powell this morning about 9 o'clock, said that he could live with the resolution even though they had sort of fiercely opposed it for weeks. And I can only guess that Syria was very nervous at the prospect of being isolated on the Security Council.
Nobody wants to be the odd man out. Colin Lynch, thank you for joining us.
All right. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Colin Lynch is United Nations correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier today from New York. When Chechen guerrillas took more than 700 hostages in a Moscow theater last month, Russian military forces stormed in, but not before pumping in a mysterious green gas that knocked out, in many cases, killed its inhalers, guerrillas, and hostages alike. The gas, categorized as a non-lethal weapon, killed more than 100 civilian hostages. But in spite of the physical and moral hazards, military thinkers say that non-lethal weapons are key to the future of military missions. They might have prevented the 1999 USS Cole bombing in Yemen. They've been proven effective in subduing riots and capturing terrorists. They give troops a middle option, shy of death for attackers. But when shooting doesn't mean killing, is it too easy to pull a trigger? And who will be the target? How many ways do you want authorities to have to subdue an enemy? Or maybe you. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Las Vegas tonight is John Alexander, author of Future War, Non-Lethal Weapons in 21st Century Warfare. Good evening and welcome, John Alexander.
Good evening. Glad to be here.
Thanks for being with us. John Alexander, you spent a long time looking at lethal weapons. You've invested a lot of focus.
Non-lethal weapons.
You've got a lot of focus here and a lot of thought behind these. Why? We know about the National Academy of Sciences report that's just come out saying the Navy and Marines ought to be looking at them more seriously, putting more effort into non-lethal. Why such a renewed interest, a new interest right now in developing non-lethal weapons?
Well, the study you're referring to, I was a member of that panel, and a lot of that was precipitated by the attack on the Cole. Now, we found a great difference between what the Marines were doing in this area and what the Navy was doing. Now, the Marines have been involved in peace support operations for quite a while, and they've been enthusiastic supporters. General Zinni, as far back as the days in Somalia, had used, as he said, a sultry number of weapons that were available, but he would not go out without them again. And so it was the operations.
What is it that's pushing this interest, John Alexander? Why do military planners, thinkers, and commanders on the ground, why are they saying now we wish we had more non-lethal weapons and we're going to need a lot more in the future?
Well, the biggest change has been operational commanders doing exactly what you're saying. They've been out in the field, particularly in peace support operations such as Somalia, Bosnia, Haiti. And they say we're confronted in a position where we need to use force, but we really don't go around killing people because in the long run, it's disadvantageous. So we'd like these middle ground options. We found them to be very effective. In Bosnia, for instance, where we've used low kinetic impact, which you think of as rubber bullets or really like beanbag bullets and things like that, we found if somebody was shot, they basically didn't come back. Now, obviously, they lived.
Shot with a non-lethal beanbag bullet.
Yeah. It's basically a one-inch square canvas bag with a little shot in it. It really hurts when it hits, but you live.
But is it all about peacekeeping, or is this also about actually fighting wars with non-lethal weapons?
Well, in my view, what's happened is that 9/11 really changed significantly our thinking in this field, I believe. And that is that I think that the wars of the future, a good share of them, are going to be fought in places like London, Paris, Rome, Washington, New York, meaning that we're going to fight terrorist cells inside of major population areas with high-density non-combatants. So you need a way to discriminate. You're going to have to use force, but you want to be able to discriminate. And that's exactly what happened in Moscow.
That is to discriminate between civilian and target or enemy?
Correct.
So you'd use a non-lethal weapon on a civilian for what purpose?
Well, when you need to separate, I mean, I think one of the things you're going to see is much more hostage-taking situations, and they're probably going to become more complex rather than less. As you know, in 9/11, again, changed our thinking about hostages. Up until that time, you wanted an operation that was perfect and everybody got out alive. Since that time, I think our thinking has shifted to how do we save the most number of people and still accomplish the mission.
John Alexander, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about the new push to develop non-lethal weapons, about the clear new focus of an ambiguous new kind of war. Can you picture a war without death or weapons that don't kill? Do we need a new breed of non-lethal weaponry for a new era of war and conflict? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. On Point, we're talking tonight about non-lethal weapons and the clear new focus of an ambiguous new kind of war. My guest tonight is John Alexander. He's a longtime advocate for the development of non-lethal weapons and author of Future War, Non-Lethal Weapons in 21st Century Warfare. What do you think? When weapons can defeat without death, are we more likely to use them? Is that good or bad? And do you want U.S. soldiers to have a choice between firing to kill and not firing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John Alexander, you know a lot about these weapons, a lot more than we do. Give us a sense of the range of weapons and technologies that's being looked at in this non-lethal category.
Well, that's really extremely broad. Now, there are weapons I think most people are aware of. If you've watched, say, the Infantata in Israel and what's going on in Northern Ireland, you're familiar with rubber bullets, if you will.
We take that as a baseline, kind of old-fashioned non-lethal.
That's pretty much the baseline. The other thing that you're familiar with are things like pepper spray that you see police use. There are tasers, which are electrical stun systems that there have really been some upgrades there. They're very effective.
These are the sort of darts that shoot out with the wires behind them that deliver a big shock.
That's one version of it, yes. Mm-hmm. It's by Taser International. In the past, that was a pain compliance system, and that was the problem you saw with Rodney King. In other words, people who were specifically chemically altered could fight through it. The new systems interrupt the neuromuscular system, and you collapse immediately.
So these are
very
these
painful.
And these are non-lethal weapons that we're relatively familiar with, but there's a whole new horizon opening up here. Sort of walk us through, from where we nearly are out to the more sci-fi thinking that's going on.
Sure. And there are some big changes that have taken place. A lot of this, by the way, is in the old adage, follow the money. As more money has become available and defense contractors, the major defense contractors have entered the picture, we've started to see some of the more exotic systems. One that's received a lot of attention is a millimeter wave system. This is something that projects a beam for a substantial distance. It's at about 95 gigahertz. It causes a substantial degree of pain.
This is a beam of light, of heat?
It's a beam of electrical energy.
That would create the sensation
like
of
microwaves.
Heat?
Well, it does heat, except it does not penetrate. It penetrates the skin only deep enough to hit the nerve endings. And a lot of misconceptions about the system, but this is one that's coming.
But you'd pull back from it the same way you would from a hot stove, in other words.
Exactly. Yeah.
What's the range
I have been
of that?
Zapped by it. And, mm-hmm. Well, I can't give you the exact range. Let's just say it's in hundreds of meters. And that's an important issue because the weapons that have been used before, the rubber bullets and those sorts of things, mm-hmm. the question has always been, is it better than a rock? And we figure a teenager can throw a rock about 180 feet. And so you want weapons that give you a standoff greater than that. And this is one of the first ones that gives you substantial standoff. So I can disperse a crowd.
So you're imagining perhaps a peacekeeper in Somalia or you name it, who we're imagining an American soldier looking out on a crowd of 300 people. He wants a way to push them back without shooting a bullet. And with this, he would be shooting out kind of a heat wave that they would – what would the crowd response be?
The crowd response would be to run away, to get out of it. All you have to do is just get out of the beam, and you would not keep it dwelling on people for a very long time, although there's no significant danger in doing that. But you would want to use it just long enough so that they understand that this is pain compliance and that allow them a path out of the area.
What other technologies are coming?
Well, one of the big ones is a laser system, an airborne laser system that can be – this is what we call anti-materiel, where it's designed to, say, shoot out the tires or cut off antennas on vehicles at very substantial distances.
But this is not to be aimed at humans, though there are also laser weapons, are there not, that would interrupt eyesight?
Well, there are flash blinding systems. I differentiate here between ones that create flash blindness and permanent blindness, which would be illegal because of laws against maiming systems. They're very controversial nonetheless. I like to say anything that potentially affects eyeballs or testicles are an emotional issue, and we don't think very terribly rational about them. But there are laser systems already that can, say, hit a windshield or the shield on a cockpit, for instance, at long ranges that prohibit the pilot from flying in or targeting people.
I've seen a list of some of these weapons. It's so long, we'll never get through it. It's kind of very impressively long. But there are a couple I want to ask about. Vortex weapons. This is a donut-shaped shockwave strong enough to knock people off their feet?
Right. Basically, it's a soliton. What you do is use compressed air. And those of you listening to the radio, in fact, particularly from the Boston area, you're familiar with Bose, who's made, you know, great advances in acoustics.
The stereo sound system. Mm-hmm.
And yes, but what that's doing is pushing air. So this is really the same system or the same basic concept amplified a considerable number of times.
And I can see this as effective crowd control. What about in warfare situations? Maybe we should start with that kind of in-between example of the USS Cole. How might non-lethal weapons have kept that little dinghy from essentially sinking that huge naval ship?
Well, that really brought, I mean, that was a case that we looked at kind of in depth. You see, there are political problems there as well, and that is that when a naval ship enters a foreign harbor, the security is the responsibility of the host nation, and that we're prohibited or have been prohibited in using force until you see action that indicates hostile intent.
So here's a little boat coming up alongside the ship, but they don't see a reason to open fire.
Right. You can't. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, by law, you do not have authorization to use it at this point. Now, you did not get hostile intent. Remember, these guys were smiling and waving until they bumped up right alongside.
So what kind of non-lethal weapon might have been brought into play there?
All right. I think there's several things. One we're looking at are barriers that can be dropped in the water that prevent small craft from coming in.
That's pretty simple.
There are others, light and acoustic systems that you can interrogate the person and sort of you warn them away. And then if they, you know, persist in coming at you, then you have some indication of their intent. Now, this area denial system, this microwave system we were just discussing, is one of those that might be used.
And we read also about spray foams that would kind of turn to cement as soon as they hit something, or is creating barriers from foam?
Well, I don't think that would be used in this case. Mm-hmm. We're finding those useful in urban operations. For instance, where you've searched an area and you want to be sure that somebody doesn't slip in behind you, so you can seal access. As we all know, that the terrorists are always hidden in the air conditioning system. So this is a quick way to seal off the air conditioner so they can't come in and drop down on your head.
We've all watched Mission Impossible. John Alexander, you outline a kind of mind-boggling array of options here, and we're just beginning to get our minds around this. I want to welcome into our conversation Matthew Messelson. He's professor of molecular biology at Harvard University, joining us tonight from Geneva, Switzerland. Good evening and welcome, Professor Messelson.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
1 o'clock in the morning here.
Yes, you're a good sport to be up at this hour, and we appreciate it. We're talking about, as you know, non-lethal weapons. The case is being made that these are going to be a key component of military conflict in the 21st century. You've said that there's no such thing as non-lethal war, and that the use of these in ordinary war, at least, is kind of a myth. What's your view of the promise of non-lethal weapons?
Well, I don't see any real objection to most of these non-lethal weapons for purposes that are permitted. The ones that I care about, in fact, are the ones that you could call chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. The main concern about the other weapons, aside from the fact of whether they really work, is that most technologies do diffuse and should be careful not to choose ones that can become widespread amongst all kinds of people, including criminals and so on.
Diffuse, you mean they come into hands, not necessarily military hands, that once the military starts using it, others will have it as well.
We developed the, you know, geographic position locators, and now anybody can do it when you take your boat out and so on, and that could have, but I want to leave that aside. Mm-hmm. I should start by saying I'm a biologist, and so I tend, and I'm an evolutionary biologist, I tend to ask questions about the longer term. And there I would start by making two propositions. If we look through the history of all the technologies that our species has developed, every one of them has been used not only for peaceful purposes, but also has been exploited energetically for hostile purposes. You could start with metallurgy. You could come right on up to modern computer science. It's true of all the previous technologies. And so reason to think that the newest technology of all, very powerful one, and we're only at the beginning of it, it's my field, is biotechnology. So we have a question here. We have two propositions that are undeniable. All technologies have been exploited for hostile purposes. Biotechnology is a great new arriving technology. Question, will it be used for hostile purposes, and what would that mean?
And when you set it up
now,
that way...
technology, that technology has the capability of doing something different from all other military technologies. Not killing, not subduing, but changing. Changing what it means to be human.
Matthew Mistelson, you're raising the huge issue, but help us put it in a little more context. What kind of chemical and biological non-lethal weapons? We usually think of these as lethal weapons, of chemical weapons and biological as things that would infect and quite likely kill the target.
Well, we shouldn't, because there's a treaty, and the United States was one of the leaders in creating it. And that treaty would prohibit all use of chemical weapons that act by any form of action on life processes that causes either temporary incapacitation or permanent harm or even death to humans or animals. So that treaty is our bulwark against biotechnology being harnessed for hostile purposes.
This is why people were upset over the use of gas in Moscow?
That would not be a violation if it was viewed as law enforcement. We use lethal gas to execute murderers. The treaty permits that because what the treaty says is that toxic chemicals, chemical weapons are all toxic chemicals except those which are used for purposes not prohibited by the convention. And so long as the types and quantities are consistent with those purposes, then there's a list of purposes, and one of those is law enforcement and domestic riot control. So it's perfectly all right. This treaty stands as a bulwark against any further use. It's perfectly all right to use chemical weapons, but there has to be law enforcement. I can't just say you're illegal. There has to be existing law, a statute. And there has to be jurisdiction to enforce it.
But we can hear, Matthew Mistelson, we can hear the ambiguity growing up here where we talk about international law, where we talk about controlling riots
and
peacekeepers. Well, peacekeepers are out there operating on international law.
Law requires that there be a statute or some other form of written law. You can't just walk into a room and say it's law. And it also must have jurisdiction to enforce. The lawyers know about this. It's not ambiguous at all.
But yet I have to say I hear in the kind of longing of the military people the desire to have non-lethal weapons, and I don't know if they include chemical and biological or not, but weapons that they can employ in situations that might fall outside of U.S. law or domestic riot control.
Well, if they need to use them with United Nations, there can be authorization and proper legal authority. The problem with non-lethal weapons in warfare is it's a myth. Imagine that you're a combat soldier and your commander tells you there are men out there with lethal weapons and they may want to kill you. And you have lethal weapons too, but please, men, don't use those. Just use your incapacitating weapons. In your ears, that comes across as saying, my commander is telling me to take an incremental risk to my life in order to do what? In order to save those guys? Come on.
Right. Can we interject?
Morale would crack.
Yes.
I would imagine that a lot of commanders would have grenades thrown at them in a situation like that.
This is silly.
John Alexander, come in here. What's your view of this critique?
This is silly. This argument has already been dispersed. Our policy is extremely clear, and it says that if lethal force is used, we respond with lethal force. The idea that we're going to use these in an incremental approach is just not valid. I mean, these are, and what I've heard is a series of academic arguments that have little practicality in the real world.
And yet we also hear Matthew Mistelson talking about sticking up for law.
Because the Air Force did a very careful study after Vietnam and found that CS was used almost universally in conjunction with lethal weapons. And I wouldn't want to have to withhold my lethal weapons if I was a combat soldier. But you're right. There are lots of military purposes which are perfectly fine. And I have no objection to these other non-lethal technologies, even for actual warfighting.
Matthew Messelson, I want to thank you for expanding our horizon here tonight, and thanks so much for joining us. Matthew Messelson is a professor of molecular biology at Harvard. He joined us tonight from Geneva, Switzerland. Andrew's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just a question. We go into a situation like Somalia, and people start throwing rocks and bottles, and somebody fires a gun from the crowd, mm-hmm. and the soldiers shoot up the crowd with an M60 machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
Press screams, massacre. We killed those poor people.
Mm-hmm.
Non-lethal weapons featuring, let's say, a machine beanbag gun.
Mm-hmm.
That really hurts, okay? As quoted by General Alexander there, okay, same situation, open up with a beanbag gun. Next day, press screams, we tortured a whole crowd of people and they're not coming back.
So where are you going with this, Andrew?
My point is that are they non-lethal weapons or are they weapons of torture?
John Alexander?
Well, there's two issues. Actually, he raised Somalia, which is very good. What most people do not understand, and the press have had this for a long time and not expand on it, we killed between 7 and 10,000 people in Somalia, and that was a peace support operation. We were there to, you know, feed starving people ostensibly.
A humanitarian mission.
Correct. The although it changed from humanitarian to nation building, and I mean, there were changes over the time.
It did, but I've stood on that street in Mogadishu where the helicopter went down, and it's hard to picture those soldiers under that kind of fire using anything other than lethal response. Is there some non-lethal technology so powerful that it might have helped, might have saved them?
Oh, I don't think we would have used non-lethal in that situation. However, there, as you know, the AC-130 gunship, probably a single gunship could have prevented what happened, or a couple of Abrams tanks. But that was a political decision as to what kind of weapons you could have on the ground.
But Andrew's asking, I guess,
soldiers.
Andrew's asking if this amounts
to deserve credit. They actually withheld fire and minimized the number of people who actually died in that circumstance.
But is the non-lethal weapon path then taking us into a kind of, I don't know, large-scale torture as opposed to death? Torture is our caller Andrew's word here. How do you see that,
well,
John Alexander?
I don't think so, because remember, the option here is what you're trying to do in most of these situations is make people go away. So they have an option of being there. They have an option of leaving. So it's not like you're tying them down and continually using this to, you know, to torture individuals. This has been an argument, particularly with the electronic systems, that they can be used for torture. Again, it gets back to intent. With weapons of this nature, a couple of critical issues are training and management, that we have commanders who know how to use them, who employ them properly. Let me digress to the incident in Seattle.
Hold that thought, John Alexander. We have to take a short break here. We'll be right back and come to that incident in Seattle. We're talking tonight about non-lethal weapons. There's a big new push to develop them for the U.S. military. Can you picture a war without death or weapons that don't kill? Do we need a new breed of non-lethal weaponry for an era, a new era of war and conflict? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about non-lethal weapons. There's a big new push on to develop non-lethal weapons that would, it is said, be or will be an essential part of the toolkit of the armaments of U.S. soldiers in the 21st century in ambiguous situations of conflict, in a war on terror, in peacekeeping missions, maybe an old-fashioned war, practicing old-fashioned war with new weapons. The question is, when weapons can defeat without death, are we more likely to use them? And is that good or bad? Would non-lethal weapons save lives or encourage oppression? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is John Alexander. He's author of Future War, Non-Lethal Weapons in 21st Century Warfare. Liza's joining us right now. Welcome, Liza. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was calling about one of your speakers talked about rubber bullets used by the Israelis military against the Palestinians as a non-lethal weapon. And I think this is far from a non-lethal weapon. If people really understand how rubber bullets work, they're often fired at essential parts of the body like the abdomen and the head. they cause terrible brain damage and maiming. And I think that this whole idea of rubber bullets, many people think of them as they just bounce off a person's skin and they cause a little pain. But that's not what they are. They're sort of marketed as a kinder and gentler mm-hmm. weapon, but they have terrible, terrible consequences.
So, Liza, let me ask you, do you fear that a move toward non-lethal weapons then diminishes the attention we pay to the use of weapons?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that they can definitely be used against, you know, civilian populations that are protesting, you know, human rights abuses, all sorts of things that are legitimately protested, and they're going to be used by military and civilian governments against their own people.
Liza, thanks for your call. John Alexander, what about it? You can well understand, on the one hand, we see the utility that you're describing. On the other hand, if misused, these do look like weapons that could be rolled out without a huge moral outrage to put down crowds, maybe crowds that we want to have out for a demonstration.
Sure. But I don't think the issue here is technology. What we tend to do here is blame technology when the problem is people. You say you've raised what we call a slippery slope argument several times. In other mm-hmm. words, are we more likely to use them? If so, that came up, I think, in the first article I ever published. And I said, you know, that's job security for Congress. If you have legislators who are prepared to go to war under more or circumstances that are less severe, then you've got the wrong legislators. I mean, war should never be taken lightly. And I think you have the same problem when we talk about use of these against civilian populations.
Well, you raised Seattle earlier.
Decision.
I wanted to ask you about that. Were you talking about the anti-globalization riots in Seattle?
Correct. But my issue there was one in which they knew they had a problem. They grabbed a host of non-lethal weapons off the shelf, handed them to officers, and said, you know, go out and stop the riot.
What was their tear gas and what else?
Well, they had a lot of them were these what I saw low kinetic impact weapons. They had pepper ball and things like that. But the point is they failed to train them. And that's a key issue. You don't want to take non-lethal weapons off the shelf. It's like taking anything and handing it to somebody and say, go out and use it.
And what were the consequences?
Without training them properly first. Part of, you know, a bit of what the prior caller was describing is accurate. And that is that there are minimum ranges. And most of these, they say you have a minimum range between the point of the muzzle and the individual, and you mm-hmm. don't want to shoot within the minimum range. Mm-hmm. In the WTO in Seattle, I saw people, you know, a guy put his foot up against somebody and pulled the trigger way, way too close, and the impact is substantial.
We see technology always raises these issues to a new level. It makes our discernment and, as you say, the way in which things are used all the more critical. But as Matthew Messelson said earlier, the history of human warfare and conflict shows that once technologies are out there, it's hard to determine how they'll be used. And we ultimately know that almost everybody yeah. will have them. Let's get another call in here. Don is calling from Bellingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Donna. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yes, I would just like to tell the general how much I appreciate his innovation and his work in exploring the use of non-lethal weapons. And I am appalled by the callers who call in and, like he said, offer ridiculous academic arguments. They have no clue about the military or how the military can benefit from this. And also, General, I'd like to commend you for your patience. I don't think you've gotten a sentence out without being interrupted. Sir, I have the greatest respect for you, and please continue your wonderful work.
Donna, thank you for your call. John Alexander, it sounds like there's a constituency out there for exactly the kind of application that you're describing, which is a third way for soldiers in a tough spot.
Yeah. And one correction, I was a colonel, not a general. So.
Okay, we got that. I want to bring David Fidler into our conversation right now. He's professor of international law at Indiana University, calling us from Bloomington, Indiana. Good evening and welcome, David Fidler.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. David Fidler, what are the I'm hearing moral and legal hazards at the same time that there are opportunities here. Help us understand the legal and moral hazards attendant to non-lethal weaponry.
Yeah, I think that it's the complexity of these issues, both on the moral and the legal side, which makes the non-lethal weapon area fascinating, exciting, but also to a certain extent worrying. There are lots of non-lethal technologies in which there are really no major problems, as Professor Mielsen said, in connection with international legal regulations. Mm-hmm. Some of the more worrying technologies in this area are non-lethal biological and non-lethal chemical weapons. And there are some serious concerns involving arms control treaties about whether the pursuit of those kinds of technologies would in fact fit within the existing international legal framework.
Can you give us some examples of worrying developments there?
Well, you have you've had a number of people arguing that the prohibitions, for example, on the development of biological weapons should only apply to lethal biological agents, and therefore countries like the United States or, and others should be allowed to develop non-lethal technologies, mm-hmm. both for purposes of anti-materiel as well as anti-personnel developments. That, I think, is a dangerous road to go down. First of all, because I think it is clear in the biological weapons context that the Biological Weapons Convention of 1972 and also under U.S. statutory law implementing that, that the development of any kind of biological weapon, lethal or non-lethal, is prohibited. And so it is a concern that you have people seriously arguing that we ought to change that prohibition on biological weapons.
Can I ask a simple
development of that? Yeah.
Let me ask a simple question. I'm still not sure I understand this vein of non-lethal biological weapons. What kind of impact might they have that would be useful, let's say, to a military?
It would be an incapacitating format, just in the same way that we're talking about incapacitating chemical agents.
So it might make people sick.
Yeah, they might make them sick, incapacitate them so they're easy to deal with, either from an armed conflict scenario, a peacekeeping scenario, or a law enforcement scenario. And it's the same argument in terms of incapacitating chemical weapons, that you want to be able to control an area for either tactical or strategic purposes, so you use an incapacitating chemical agent, and therefore you can then separate the bad guys from the good guys or deal with the bad guys easier as you move forward in a military operation or in connection with a law enforcement operation.
Let me put that to John Alexander. Mr. Alexander, do you agree, is there an area of legal ambiguity, or are there even legal obstacles to the applications you have in mind? Do you think that the law needs to be changed or the technology needs to be corralled?
Well, we've debated this before, so I'm welcoming to the show. We had quite a debate in Edinburgh over this issue. We do agree that we see it differently. I think the primary biological weapons you see are what we call anti-materiel. And the problem here is that trash is a global problem, and that bioremediation is advancing very, very rapidly. You think of oil slicks, for instance. We have bugs that eat oil.
Mm-hmm.
So it's now not a matter of developing weapons per se, but it's merely an application of the technology.
So here's a civilian application, you're saying?
Slick, mm-hmm. Well, there is. Yeah, we use them for cleaning up oil slicks. I can take the same bugs, if you will, and attack a national fuel supply.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I think this is the issue where the particularly the morality and legality get quite interesting, because I know Colonel Alexander has made the case quite eloquently that if you're concerned about the development of non-lethal weapons, you have to ask the question, compared to what?
Mm-hmm.
If it leaves you with the choice of using lethal technology because you've prohibited the development of non-lethal technology, that opens the question of whether we ought to be looking at some of these legal restrictions. And if we don't want to move in the direction that Colonel Alexander is saying in connection with bioremediation, these sorts of technologies,
mm-hmm.
we have to change the law. And so it's not a question on the biological weapons side. We'd have to change U.S. statutory law, and we would then have to renegotiate the Biological Weapons Convention. So it is a serious moral and legal sticking point, even if you see the appeal of moving towards these sorts of technologies. The legality of this gets even more complicated when you start talking about chemical weapons and the law enforcement versus armed conflict, the things that Professor Mieselson was talking about. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there you have, again, you have this strange situation where you can use a chemical weapon for a law enforcement purpose, including riot control.
Mm-hmm.
So you could use an incapacitating chemical weapon for domestic law enforcement, but you can't use the same incapacitating chemical weapon on the battlefield.
It gets into some odd combinations. I want to ask you, on the one hand, we can well understand why the sailors on the USS Cole could have used something to keep this dinghy at bay that ultimately killed so many and brought that ship down. On the other hand, there's a kind of bizarre security in the horrible choice that lethal weapons present, because you know, if you there's a strange defense in a way of freedom. If you use it, you're making a life and death decision, so you're less likely to use it. Does that create a kind of, I don't know, moral slippery slope on this front, too? If we have these weapons, David Fidler, we're more likely to impinge on the freedom of others for one way or another.
I think it's a serious concern. I mean, Colonel Alexander has a point in saying we have to separate, to some extent, technology from people. And if Congress and the president are more likely to use force because they have non-lethal weapons at their disposal, that's a political problem as opposed to a technological problem. The argument that I would make in response to that is, mm-hmm. at the same time that you do have to focus on the political intent, you do have to focus on that people and technology go together.
Yes.
Just look, for example, at our willingness to intervene in Kosovo because we thought we could do the job strictly with air power. Mm. That's a technological development, our prowess in air supremacy that allows us to intervene without the use of ground forces.
It affects behavior. Let me try and get one more call in here. Steve's calling from Sandwich. Oh, I'm sorry. Bonnie's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Bonnie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to ask a specific question of Colonel Alexander mm-hmm. about the testing of these non-lethal weapons. What kind of injuries have either the people or the animals they've tested on sustained, and how have they recovered? Have they been able to recover?
We've got it. Thanks, Bonnie. John Alexander?
Terribly complex problem. I might add that in the National Research Council study, one of the things that we advocated most strongly is that we concentrate efforts in understanding the effects. But the question really is so broad because it ranges, you know, across the spectrum of weapons, from impact weapons, where a lot of work has been done, including shooting cadavers and things like that, to understand penetration mechanics.
But presumably there's everything from animals to live human beings at some point used.
Sure. And they all follow standard protocols. In other words, anytime you have human use, everybody knows that if you're working in any academic or government institution, you have human use boards and you have to have your protocols approved before you do that. The same is true for use in animal testing.
So the humans would presumably know what they're in for. Animals might not.
Well, you have to sign in. It's not only informed consent, but that, you know, the protocols are thought through and approved. You have medical doctors, chaplains, common people, mm-hmm. all involved in these committees. It's a very well-articulated process.
Bonnie, thanks for your call. John Alexander, our time is almost up. Do you foresee a day when non-lethal weapons might be used large-scale in actual warfare to immobilize entire battalions, armies?
I do see some major changes coming, but not in the immediate future. I think more you're going to see them used in, as I say, discriminating systems, in particularly counter-terrorist operations where you've got problems of large numbers of combatants commingled with a number of adversaries, mm-hmm. particularly in combat in urban areas. I think it's going to become a critical issue there.
And that could come up soon. Colonel John Alexander, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
John Alexander is author of Future War, Non-Lethal Weapons in 21st Century Warfare. And David Fidler, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
David Fidler is professor of international law at Indiana University. Listeners, you can continue this conversation on non-lethal weapons online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.